First of our speakers on the panel today is Steve McNench. Steve is CEO of Western Plains Energy, which is located near Oakley, Kansas. Steve started operation of the 30 million gallon a year plant there in 2004, and they've gradually expanded that to 50 million gallons at present, using both grain sorghum and corn. Steve's been very active in the Kansas Biofuels Association, serves on the Growth Energy Board of Directors. Please welcome Steve McNench.
First, I want to thank Darren for setting the mood for the next presenters to get up and talk to. I'll go through some of this pretty quickly. Some of it's really technical. But one of the things as an industry that we need to continue to focus on, RFS2, while a significant portion of that initially is corn-based, and the way it's structured together, and I'll get to that in about the middle of the presentation, is we will get through this problem fine, and I can't remember any time the country's ever ran out of corn. I think we're all going to pay more for it this year than we want to, but I don't think we're going to run out. What we're doing at Western Plains is trying to transition over into what is called the other advanced categories of the RFS2. And what we're doing is, in a time of extremely low natural gas prices, building a methane plant. So I think my board of directors occasionally questions my sanity when I brought that up. But also the utilization of grain sorghum as a feedstock. And with the recent announcement and NOTA period with EPA, we're able to walk down that path. And what we did was we've looked heavily at different fuel sources to power the plant with, whether it be CHP, anaerobic digestion, and so forth. The problem with anaerobic digestion wasn't that it was a novel technology. The problem always has been an anaerobic digester. If you're familiar with them, over time they fill up with dirt and sand, and you have to shut them down and clean them out. Running an ethanol plant, you need a constant energy source for the plant. You can't really take the natural gas usage off for 30 days and clean out tank. And we stumbled upon technology out of Canada where we're able to clean the tanks basically every 2 hours and never interrupt the system. There are tremendous potentials for economic impact, not only from the value of the alcohol, but just value of the plant in general. And at the very end, I'll go through some case studies, both our plant and this technology's plant in Canada. The neat thing about anaerobic digestion is you can utilize a tremendous amount of feedstocks. The most common we think about is manure from feedlots or other CAFO operations. But basically, and this summer would be a good example, if you could have laid it outside in July and it smelled bad after a couple days, you could have put it in an anaerobic digester and made energy out of it. Some of the challenges with them, obviously, is the sand and grit, but also, along with methane, you get a pretty good stream of CO2 that you have to be able to burn correctly or get that volume through your digester, but also you get H2S that poses its own problems. You don't want to make sulfuric acid and try to run it through a boiler, so you've got to get that out. Again, this technology is unique. And another aspect, most of the digestion in the United States is what's called mesophilic digestion, or it runs at ambient temperature, most common probably in the dairy operations. This one is thermophilic, so we'll actually be providing energy into it to raise the temperature. It makes the system drive more to completion. It also makes it quicker. It also makes it a hair unstable. Some of the benefits from co-locating with an ethanol plant is one of the other things that people don't generally look at. We talk a lot about the Clean Air Act, but we talk very little about the Clean Water Act. Water that comes out of an anaerobic digester is heavily laden with both phosphorus and nitrogen. Two of the elements that EPA is concerned about, particularly with the Gulf of Mexico and our waterways around the country. I don't speak of it publicly much, but I've served with the EPA on an advisory panel for the last 2 years, and all we dealt with was the Clean Water Act. And I can tell you, as we've talked through this and co-locating with the system, all of us that use an ethanol plant put nitrogen in our process. This nitrogen in organic form can be fed back in through the cleaned up water supply to help offset some of our nitrogen needs in the plant, provide a solution for that the EPA really appreciates. The other thing that you can do, not only in our application, initially all we're going to do is fire the boilers, you can also put in electric generation, produce your own power. Theoretically, you can very quickly then come completely off the grid. Um, There are large amounts of feedstocks that are needed. We'll see some pictures here in a minute. Our beer well at the plant is roughly 3/4 million gallon vessel. Each one of the four digester tanks that you'll see in the future are 1.5 million gallons. And then there's another 8 million gallons of tertiary digesters that go along with that. So the footprint that you'll see, the methane facility feeding the ethanol plant will greatly exceed the overall footprint of the ethanol plant when we get done. But the neat thing is the total solids reduction that's done through this, it's basically 5-to-1. So 80% of the solids that come in are consumed and converted into methane. And what you're left with at the end, those of us that are around CAFOs are familiar with the manure harvesting that goes on. It has to be composted along the sides of the field for a long period of time. The digesters do that composting for you. You end up with the Class A fertilizer, 100% pathogen free and ready to be spread immediately. We talked a little bit about the grain sorghum pathway. If you remember back when the RFS2 was originally implemented, grain sorghum was mentioned. The EPA was going to get right on that and have this pathway finished in 2010. It was just finished in July of 2012, so it's been a long time coming. I can tell you, working with National Sorghum, as well as Greg Krissick and some others, EPA was very open in the process. They were very willing to come to us and say, this is what we're looking at. And we're listening. They understood they're not the USDA, so there were some assumptions they were using that weren't quite correct. Currently, there's roughly, we assume, 15 plants in the Midwest that use a high degree of grain sorghum in their operations. This year, for example, our facility was about 95% grain sorghum, very little corn. There's very minimal process difference when you grind grain sorghum and corn. Pretty much the only real difference is you add one more enzyme than a traditional corn plant would do. You add protease and fermentation. And currently the only large-scale importer of other advanced biofuel is Brazilian sugarcane ethanol. This is the same slide that you just saw from Darren just a little bit ago. But this is a slide in numeric form. The one thing I want to point out, and this is what the renewable fuel standard looks like in just pure numbers. And this year in 2012, you have the first requirement for other advanced biofuel, 500 million gallons. Again, that's being filled today by Brazil. The one thing that we tend, you know, we've heard a lot of speakers talk this morning about, there's a lot of flexibility with the carried over RINs and that aspect. The one part that we tend to forget about is that 13.2 billion gallon number for corn-based ethanol on the right is not a minimum, it's a maximum. The minimum number is zero. The way this standard was put in place is it is a stack standard. The farther you are on the left, the more power you have over the standard. If, for example, we were making 14 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol, there would be no need to make corn-based ethanol. One of the concerns as we make other advanced has always been Brazilian sugar-based ethanol. In a year like this, that's a good thing. If Brazil has a huge sugar crop and can make alcohol and we don't have corn, this standard is not only met by U.S. producers, it can be met from around the world. When we have a lot of corn or grain sorghum, whatever, we don't necessarily like it. But this year it's going to come in handy because the cellulosic numbers you see on the left, the reason they're so small is because we haven't produced them. That's one of the arguments that we're being fought with in court today by the refiners is being forced to use something they can't buy. Well, as several of us are moving into the other advanced categories, we're filling that and can help offset some of the corn demand. I like this chart after we've seen corn production numbers. This is grain sorghum production numbers around the country. It's a little bit smaller than the corn belt. The neat thing about grain sorghum, when I do the analogy, corn would be a quarter horse, grain sorghum would be a mule. In years like this, the quarter horse runs really hard until he runs out of water, then he dies. Grain sorghum stops and he's really stubborn and he'll wait for it to rain a little bit longer. We are finding that it does eventually need the rain or it won't last either, but you can see the grain sorghum is Kansas is the largest grain sorghum producing state in the country. Texas is number two. And traditionally, it's a hot weather crop. These are where most of the beef CAFOs are located. And the ironic thing is, if you pull up dairy CAFOs, it's the same map. I don't think USDA does a very good job of explaining the difference between the two. But where anaerobic digestion comes in handy, you need the bacteria set that comes from the manure. That's why it's such a high feedstock for it. And those of us that are in the grain sorghum belt and in the beef belt, it's a natural match. Economic benefits can be significant. If natural gas was $5 or higher, like it has been traditionally, you're basically directly offsetting that. When you compare an anaerobic digestion system to an ethanol plant, the complexity of an anaerobic digester is minimal compared to the ethanol plant. Basically, you're doing a controlled rot of substances in tanks. So if you think about it, from operating an ethanol plant, you spend 24 hours a day making sure it's not infected. I'll now have another facility that I spend 24 hours a day making sure it is infected and trying to make sure those two don't go mingle. They're very complementary. It's really a win-win. You're taking a waste product from the local environment that is under as much scrutiny as any other, which is waste from the feedlots or the CAFOs. And the interesting thing is, it's almost toxic waste while it's sitting in that CAFO. But if you can figure a way to get it through the gate, it becomes gold. It's a natural fertilizer that, when treated right, is beneficial to the environment. And you're further reducing your carbon load from a fossil fuel standpoint on the environment. Just our facility alone, when we did the math, it equates to about 6,500 homes worth of natural gas every single day that no longer will be pulled out of the pipeline. This case study is done off of the ethanol plant currently being built in Canada. This is its carbon footprint at the end. They did this a little different. Their facility, they built the facility and been generating power and putting on the grid in Canada for about 6 years. So now they're in the process of building an ethanol plant alongside of it. And their carbon score when they get done is negative. It'll actually be a carbon sink when they get done. Some of the benefits. Again, this is assuming $5 natural gas. We all know that's not where it's at today. But it would be, assuming historical gas levels, about a $5 million offset a year. There are, if you went to 100% electrical generation too, you generate a little over $3 million in savings from your electrical costs. The neat thing about waste for a digester is some people are willing to pay you to take their stuff and get rid of it for them. So you get potential tipping fees. You have a very good fertilizer at the end, and if you care to, you could go into the greenhouse gas credits at the end as well. And then that brings you back to the NOTA from EPA on the grain sorghum. There is a actual pathway they put in there, assuming it goes through with biogas and combined heat and power, where you would automatically qualify. In the EPA process, you can also petition independently as a plant, which we did last fall, and are about as far along through the process as the NOTA is itself. And all indications are it will turn out favorable. I updated this Friday. The RIN value for a D5 RIN as of Friday was 50 cents a gallon. It's pretty easy math. 50 million gallons times 50 cents, $25 million a year, an increased potential for the revenue for the gallon. Now, this is the corn RINs today they've climbed a little bit. They're about 4 cents now where they were 2 cents. As more and more of us make advanced biofuel, that value will come down. It's a market-driven institution, but there is incentive the market's giving those of us in the industry to try to move from one category to the other. Economic impacts, depending on the configuration, increases in the staff component, 50 million gallon a year plant, full replacement, you're going to need about 6 to 8 employees. Again, it's not nearly as complex as it is for an ethanol plant, or around $750,000 a year. Your increased maintenance costs are going to go up. You use about 50% more electricity than you currently use to run all the pumps and widgets in the digester. So your total cost increases about $3 million a year. That's before somebody like Randy gives you a loan to build it, and you have to pay a little bit for debt. But So if you do that math, this gets real busy, but at current RIN values, the cost payback is quick. So what I'm trying to say here is this year's going to be tough, but we as an industry have to continue to fight and move farther down the road. And one way to do that is continue to fill those buckets in the RFS that we, you know, we've done a very amazing job in the last 5 years of filling the corn bucket. And now several of us need to start moving on to fill the other buckets as well. This is what the graphs look like from a financial impact. Again, these are due to the high RIN values that are out there. But you can see there's a significant market-driven way to finance that debt, to get it paid off. And that's the way the ethanol industry was built for the last 10 years. There's no reason to think it's not going to continue down that path moving forward. The case studies, Green Power Harry Hill is the name of the ethanol facility. The technology company is called Highmark. They're just outside of Edmonton in Alberta, Canada. When I first visited them, it was in January. So it's kind of tropical to go just east of Edmonton, Canada in January. There's 30,000 head feedlot up there, open air feedlot. I didn't realize cattle's hair grows that long, but it was cold. But the digesters were functioning well. They too believe they'll be able to qualify again. It's not just an American company that can qualify for a RIN in the United States. If the petition correctly and filed correctly, it's a worldwide market. This is what they look like. The two smaller vessels you see there are the original digester facilities. The bigger one you see at the top is the bigger version. It's the same version that we're building there. You can tell this was probably taken about the same time I was up there. It was really tropical up there. I asked them, you know, just how cold does it get? And they said, actual air temperature is about 50 degrees below zero. And I said, I understand you can't leave when it's 50 degrees below zero, but when it thaws out, why does anybody stay here? This is the current ethanol facility being built there today. It is an ICM facility. Again, who we are, a 50 million gallon ethanol plant just outside of Oakley, Kansas. Within 6 miles, there's 50,000 head of cattle in a feedlot. That's the facility that we'll be using the manure from. Again, the digesters, tanks themselves are 1.5 million gallons. Inside of those is the patented technology that allows us to clean them out. We did file our petition with EPA last October. We should be operational with the digesters yet this fall. Just for scale, those are the pads. When we started pouring the pads for the digesters, they don't look much because there's not much around them. This is them going up. They were continuous slip form tanks, so they were 24 hours a day for about 10 days pouring them, day and night. That's them as they became complete. And this is a scale, gives you some sort of scale. The ethanol plant is just to the north of that. So you can see just the footprint of the digesters is as large as the ethanol facility. You can start to see the receiving buildings. And the interesting thing about Western Kansas is there's a reason we had a dust bowl. In order to have something that big set on top of the ground in Western Kansas, you have to dig a really big hole and then fill it back up. So the stormwater pond you see to the left, although it is for stormwater, was really we dug a hole to fill a hole. The two tertiary digesters you see at the bottom, each one of those holes is 4 million gallons worth of capacity. All that dirt went into the hole, and we dug out our original stormwater pond and fill it back up too. But that total site where the digester sits is about 18 acres. And we'll produce roughly 25 to 2,600 MMBTUs of gas, methane, a day to feed the ethanol plant. The way we proceeded was we went through a full-blown feasibility study. We actually brought scale model digesters on the site, fed them the ingredients that we anticipate feeding the digester. And the neat thing is, the bigger the scale gets, the more gas you get. So we were able to produce more than enough gas to fill our need from the pilots we did for the 90 days that we ran it.